Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We talk about health and nutrition and healing, the environment, more commentaries on important social themes than any other radio program or television program in the United States. 15 hours a week of live broadcasting, more than 300 original in-depth investigative reports. Today, we will continue with one of those. As many people in this audience are aware, there is a controversy involving the actual causes of autism spectrum disorder. It is not one condition, it is many different conditions, from very mild to major and debilitating. Right now, there is no consensus on the causes of autism, but some things have been ruled out as no longer allowed on the table. For example, we've been told that the official position of the CDC, the FDA, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Pediatrics, that autism is not due at any level to any single or combination vaccines or to any single or combination of ingredients such as mercury or thimerosal or aluminum, formaldehyde. Instead, we've been told or led to believe with some sense of certainty by official positions that autism is due to genetics, that your child just unfortunately happened to be the canary in the coal mine, that where all the other children who receive a vaccine are completely normal, your child had a susceptibility due to genetics, but the vaccine was not the cause. On the other side of this, we have hundreds of thousands of parents who say that their children were completely normal in their development until one or more vaccines were given, and then they receded into that dark place of non-communication. These parents do not have insurance for this. Frequently, they will spend the rest of their adult lives caring for these individuals until they get too large, and then they're put into institutions, and you've never heard a story, not a documentary, not a piece of television footage showing you what happens when children are too big and maybe too aggressive or violent to be kept at home, and they're putting into an institution and kept chronically sedated. It is something out of a sci-fi film. There have been several individuals within science and medicine, as well as some conscientious journalists, who have decided to challenge the official version. In so doing, they have come up with various reports that suggest that, yes, indeed, there is compelling evidence, not just here but around the world, that vaccines have never been proven for any given child or group of children or adults or senior citizens or pregnant women safe and effective. The latest on this is being shared at this moment by various vaccine advocacy groups that are opposed to mandatory vaccine, that the largest outbreak of whooping cough in the United States and California, that almost 100% of the children have received at least four or maximum amounts of their whooping cough vaccine, and yet they are coming down with the whooping cough at a higher percentage of the population than those who were not vaccinated. And yet these contradictions, which are rampant within the history of vaccine science, have never been honestly or accurately addressed. Even such things as herd immunity has been challenged by leading immunologists. But no matter who voices a concern or shows evidence that the science of trusting completely should be challenged, these people are given no credibility at all. More often than not, they are attacked. They are personally attacked, and whatever they're presenting has been attacked. And more often than not, behind those attacks are front people, organizations, think tanks, or foundations representing the pharmaceutical industry. Even many of the scientists sitting on the advisory committees of the government are themselves paid input, meaning they're getting stipends, research grants, they own percentages of vaccines. And yet this is what the American media has allowed to happen. These people to come forward, who clearly have a conflict of interest, to state the vaccines are safe. Anyone denying the vaccine is safe and necessary is irresponsible and even dangerous. With that, I bring on my show right now the gentleman who is the most current victim in this. He is Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Dr. Wakefield is an academic gastroenterologist specializing in inflammatory bowel disease and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or the MMR. He is a former fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons and has published over 130 original scientific papers and book chapters in peer-reviewed journals. In 1998, he and his colleagues at the Royal Free Hospital in London reported a novel inflammatory bowel disease in children with developmental disorders such as autism. Dr. Wakefield resisted pressure to stop his investigations into a possible link between vaccinations, intestinal inflammation, and autism. He left the hospital in 2001 to further pursue his research into neurological injury to children and its possible relationship to environmental causes such as immunization, but not limited to immunization. In 2001, he was awarded the Fellowship of the Royal College of Pathologists and is a medical advisor to the British charity Visceral and a board member of the American Charity of Medical Interventions for Autism. Here is what you've been watching. If you've watched Anderson Cooper and CNN or many of the other individuals, you have seen him pillared. You've seen him attacked. You've seen him called numerous names, that his work was fraudulent, that he intentionally, with malice aforethought, manipulated the parents of the children, that he cherry-picked what he wanted, that he claimed that these children did not have previous conditions when they may have, that would have changed the nature of the outcome. In other words, he engaged in fraudulent science. He has been rebuked by the official medical oversight board with his loss of his license. He has also had his article expunged from the record of the British Medical Journal, The Lancet, and he has been repudiated, and he has been vilified. All of this because of one individual. Now, when I watched Anderson Cooper and I watched the other people, I saw them attacking Wakefield, always on the defensive, was he. Never once did I see that they had done an independent piece of investigation on the background of the person attacking him. We know in the United States we have a group of people called quackbusters. They have been completely discredited in courts of law. When they finally were sued, they've lost every case. But more importantly, in those court cases, and as a matter of official court record, their so-called claims to objectivity and expert and insight and being authorities have all been completely smashed aside. They are experts in nothing relative to the health field, and so the record states. Why is it that this reporter was not given the same type of critical investigation? So Dr. Wakefield lost his job at the Royal Free College Hospital, Royal Free Hospital, his career medical license, and it's interesting that when Dr. Wakefield released his memoir about his struggle with the government and health authorities and the British international oligarchical elite of medicine, entitled "Callous Disregard: Autism Vaccines: The Truth Behind the Tragedy," the United Kingdom issued a release that he is officially banned from practicing medicine. And as a result, they have timed this, I think, to maximize the discrediting process of him. That is the introduction, as extended as it is. Now over to you, Dr. Wakefield. Welcome to our program, Dr. Wakefield.
Gary, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be back on.
Dr. Wakefield, before we go to you, the reporter and the press have so claimed that you victimized these families, you used them, you abused them, you lied to them, you manipulated them so that you can come up with this bogus amount of research. However, I'm not aware that anywhere what we're about to hear was made a part of the official record. I did not hear this on Anderson Cooper or the other American or British media. We're going to play you the actual statement from the actual parents who you work with in this investigation that you originally did. And here's the parent side of the story, an interesting piece of the puzzle that has been intentionally and with malice aforethought left out of virtually all of the reporting on you.
We're writing to you as parents of the children who, because of their symptoms of inflammatory bowel disease and associated autism, were seen at the Royal Free Hospital Pediatric Gastroenterology Unit by Professor Walker Smith and Dr. Simon Murch, with the involvement of Dr. Andrew Wakefield on the research side of their investigations. Our children became the subject of a paper published in The Lancet in 1998. We know these three doctors are being investigated by the General Medical Council, the GMC, on the basis of allegations made to them by a freelance reporter. Among the many allegations made are the suggestions that the doctors acted inappropriately regarding our children, that Dr. Wakefield solicited them for research purposes, and that our children had not been referred in the usual way by their own GPs. It's also claimed that our children were given unnecessary and invasive investigations for the purpose of research, and not in their interest. We know that this was not so. All of our children were referred to Professor Walker Smith in the proper way in order that their severe, long-standing and distressing gastroenterological symptoms could be fully investigated and treated by the foremost paediatric gastroenterologists in the UK. Many of us had been to several other doctors in our quest to get help for our children, but not until we saw Professor Walker Smith and his colleagues were full investigations undertaken. We were all treated with utmost professionalism and respect by all three of these doctors. Throughout our children's care at the Royal Free Hospital, we were kept fully informed about the investigations recommended and the treatment plans which evolved. All of the investigations were carried out without distress to our children, many of whom made great improvements on treatment, so that for the first time in years, they were finally pain-free. We've been following the GMC hearings with distress, as we, the parents, have had no opportunity to refute the allegations. For the most part, we've been excluded from giving evidence to support these doctors, whom we all hold in very high regard. It's for this reason that we're writing to the GMC and to all concerned to be absolutely clear that the complaint that is being brought against these three caring and compassionate physicians does not in any way reflect our perception of the treatment offered to our sick children at the Royal Free. We are appalled that these doctors have been the subject of this protracted inquiry in the absence of any complaint from any parent about any of the children who were reported in the Lancet paper.
That is what was missing in all the personal attacks against Wakefield and his colleagues, the so-called victims. Well, you just heard the victims speak as one. Dr. Wakefield, please tell us what you believe is behind this and give us more insight, specific and documented, that you have about the person who has been the single voice leading this charge against you and the study that you finished, and tell us the results of that study. And then I'm giving you an opportunity to take each of the points that were raised against you and give us your counterpoint. The forum is yours.
Gary, thank you very much indeed. And it was very heartening to hear that letter once again from Rosemary Keswick, the first mother who ever contacted me about her damaged child on May the 17th, 1995. I shall never forget it. And since that time, at the Royal Free, by the time that I left, we had seen nearly 200 patients. And I should say we were astonished by how consistent the disease was that we had found in the intestine of these children, and were enormously reassured that treatment of that disease had led to their improvement. So here were children who had been written off effectively by the psychiatrists and the mainstream autism medical profession, who were destined to be put into long care institution with their suffering and ignored. And we were able to do something. And for me, and you mentioned, Gary, earlier that I was a victim, I don't feel like a victim. I feel enormously privileged to have been involved in the care of these children and helping them in this way. And I'm afraid there is a price to pay for that, particularly when one conflicts with policy and profit And this is a story that was written long before any of us were born. It's the history of medicine and science, and one has to be prepared to accept that, to take that hit in order to make progress. But the price for not doing it, the price for shunning these founders, the price for walking away and saying, yes, I know what you're telling me is true, but in fact, it's going to be uncomfortable for my career, and therefore, you're on your own. I can't do that. That's not the way I operate, and that doesn't make me particularly clever or brave. It just is what I signed up to do when I went into medicine. The it's very, very interesting, Gary, when these issues come up. There was a poll last year, which I'm sure you'll be aware of, out of the University of Michigan, where they asked parents on their perceptions of vaccine safety, and over half of them considered that vaccines could cause serious harm, and 25% of parents thought that vaccines caused autism. Now, that was against a barrage of public relations attack against me and my colleagues, against the parents who questioned vaccine safety or who considered that their children had been damaged by the vaccine. Now, I saw a poll just this week from Ohio, a popular poll, and now that number is approaching 61%. Of parents. And what that tells me, whatever the relative merits of those two polls, what that tells me is that that public relations campaign, funded by industry, by the CDC, by the sort of corporate and government alliance, has failed. It has failed completely and utterly. The public do not believe the lie any longer. The vaccine safety studies have not been done. Where they have been done, they have been wholly inadequate. And I was at a meeting recently of experts from around the world listening to this in Jamaica, and people telling me about the Gardasil trials, where the placebo arm of the Gardasil trial was the aluminum adjuvant, the adjuvant that people were particularly concerned about, given the neurotoxic and immunotoxic potential for aluminum. What was it doing in the placebo arm, which should be an entirely inert compound? It shouldn't be an active compound about which there are independent safety concerns. That isn't a safety trial. That isn't a trial upon which one should base a licensing decision. And so another thing that struck me recently was the issue about the contamination of the rotavirus vaccine. There you had the discovery of a virus, a vaccine that they say had been tested exhaustively, the discovery of a pig virus DNA, genetic material from a pig virus in that vaccine. And rightly at the time, the FDA withdrew the vaccine from GlaxoSmithKline on the basis that it had a single pig virus in a pig virus, in fact, that had never been shown to cause disease in pigs. And then several months later, it was discovered that the Merck vaccine had not one, but two pig viruses in. And the second pig virus, porcine circovirus type 2, was in fact a pathogen. It caused disease in weanling pigs, an AIDS-like disease. What do? They put both vaccines back on the market. That is staggering, and that is why the public do not trust them. So the message really, Gary, is not to the parents, because the parents trust their instincts, they know what's happening, they know when they're being lied to, but the message here is for the regulators and the industry. You have lost. You have lost very, very badly. And no one really cares about you losing, except that you're losing on behalf of the children of this country, indeed the children of the world. And it's time to get on with the job or get out. Now, coming to Brian Deer, now I've been very reluctant in the past to go after Brian Deer, because he's a rather tragic individual with his own problems, and I have, for that reason, resisted any personal attack. But I would say this, in the light of the fact that I have been called a liar by him and by Anderson Cooper on his program. There's been no lie, there's been no falsification, there's been no fraud, no hoax on our part whatsoever. What we did was to give an honest representation of the clinical presentation, the clinical findings, and the research findings in these children, as we saw it. And that is basic clinical medicine. And that work, the discovery of novel bowel disease in these children, has been replicated around the world. Anderson called me a liar. He said that I was a liar because it hadn't been replicated. In fact, the discovery of the bowel disease has been replicated in published literature from as far afield as Venezuela, from Canada, from the United States of America, from Italy, from Poland, and elsewhere. So the work has been replicated, and what is fortunate is that those children who benefited from being investigated properly have been treated and have improved as a consequence. And the tragedy of Brian Deer's stories, the tragedy of Brian Deer's lies, is that those the children, the many more children who should have benefited from appropriate medical intervention have not done so. Now, it's a very bold thing to call someone a liar. So let me just give you a for instance so that you don't feel vulnerable in this. The very first time that Brian Deer became involved in investigating autism and me and the Lancet 12 children in particular, he interviewed Rosemary Keswick, the lady who you just heard reading that letter on behalf of the Lancet parents. He gained access to her house, to the house of a grieving, distressed mother with a very badly damaged child under a false name. He did not give his name as Brian Deer. He gave his name as something quite different in order to deceive her. That is a lie. And in my book, Gary, once a liar, always a liar. So that is the measure of the man that the British Medical Journal, the British Medical Association, the General Medical Council, Anderson Cooper, whoever you like, that is the measure of the man that they have invested their trust and their faith in. That is Brian Deer, and that is probably all that needs to be said about him. Except to say one thing, and you did ask me to address a specific issue. So let me give you a for instance. We were accused of fraud on the basis that records that came from the general practitioners of these children, their family doctors, did not, in certain respects, match the history that we had obtained from the parents at the Royal Free. Now, just as a matter of fact, and you will appreciate this, Gary, is that we were not privy to those records from the general practitioners. The general practitioner writes a referral letter to the expert, to the gastroenterologist in this case. We were not, nor did we ever have access to the clinical records of the children from earlier on. So we relied upon a new history taken afresh from the parents. Deer has argued that it was fraud on the basis that there was discordance between those two sets of records. Well, we didn't have the first set of records, so there could have been no discordance that was manipulated or calculated on our part. However, when we did have access to those records from the general practitioners as part of the General Medical Council proceedings, I was able to scrutinize them in great detail. And let me give you just one example of what he said. Child 2, he said that child 1, the first child to come to see us, had evidence of autism before their MMR, but we ignored this and said that it started immediately after MMR. And he quotes deafness. The child had problems hearing. Well, deafness is not part of autism, but children can appear to present with impaired hearing because they lose their attention, they lose their ability to engage. In fact, what it said in the records is that the child had difficulty hearing and mother was concerned about a discharge from his ear. That latter part was completely missed out by Brian Deer. What that indicates is that the child had a very likely an ear infection, and that was the source of his hearing problems. It had nothing to do with incipient autism whatsoever. In other words, the mother's story was correct, our story was correct, and Brian Deer's story, either because he is incompetent or deliberately, was wrong. And that is an example of what he put before the British Medical Journal in order to prove that we were guilty of scientific fraud. It's pathetic. It's absolutely pathetic. And it's most particularly pathetic that the British Medical Journal, who are meant to be and have been in the past a reputable medical journal, did not scrutinize that. Now, the important thing to say, Gary, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak in this way. When we spoke before, I talked to you about my book, Callous Disregard. All of these allegations made by Brian Deer are at least 1 year old. There's nothing new here at all. They were made by Brian Deer at least a year ago. And that gave me the opportunity in my book to address each and every allegation comprehensively. Comprehensively. And that is in the book, in the chapter entitled Dear. Did he bring that to the attention of the British Medical Journal? No. Did they independently scrutinize that information to check their facts before going out and defaming all of the doctors involved in that study? No. And that is a level, a measure of the level at which this mundane process is operating. This isn't science. This is a smear campaign at its very worst, and that is why it's failing, because the public have seen through it, and it will continue to fail.
One last issue, if you would, please. You've given us a couple of very specific, concrete examples of the manipulation of data. For whatever reason, we will not know, and I don't ascribe motive. I simply say if something is wrong, it is wrong. But if information then is used to attack you and other legitimate doctors and scientists based upon misinformation, then it only accumulates. Well, give us two more pieces of specific information of a challenge to you by Deere and the medical society that you can absolutely show irrefutably is wrong.
All right, Gary, are there any particular instances that you would like
just
to...
I was looking at all the arguments. Just you take any two that you wish.
One of the allegations against me is that that I was responsible for measles epidemics in the UK and the death of children. And that is something for which I was responsible personally. And I think that it's even been said on American television as a consequence of that allegation that if this is true, then I'm guilty of murder. And this is an extraordinary level for which the debate to reach. All I said in response to that paper when it came out was that this does not prove an association between MMR vaccination and autism. The paper said that. Now, that is not even an association, let alone a causal association. That is one thing. And the second thing is that I recommended that children continue to get vaccinated, albeit that I recommended the single vaccines, measles, mumps, and rubella, individually rather than the combination vaccine, because it was with that vaccine that there was a problem. Now, I was accused of causing a vaccine scare that led to a fall in the vaccine uptake and children dying. In fact, the single vaccines were available at that time. And a number of observers have said that I said this in the absence of the availability of those single vaccines. They were available at the time. What actually happened, Gary, is that 6 months after I made that recommendation, the British government withdrew the importation license for the single vaccines, thereby depriving parents of the opportunity to get their children vaccinated at all if they had concerns about the safety of MMR. It was the British government that was responsible for the fall in vaccination uptake, and if there have been cases of measles and even deaths since then, it is wholly at the door of the British government for that issue, and not my fault. I urged parents to continue vaccinating with available vaccines at the time.
But you realize what they did. They said that you were post-vaccines, and you made a claim that vaccines caused the autism, neither of which is true. You have documented that in your book. I have read that. You have stated that in the paper. So they have created arguments out of pure cloth to use against you. That should already show people in this audience that there is a systematic campaign. We're used to that in the United States. We have prostitution in science that is so bad, and in our media that is so reprehensible that we don't even pretend to have objective media in the United States anywhere, least of all CNN. And of course, as you've seen, the consequence of that is the Anderson Coopers of the world. So in any case, one more example, and we will end this discussion with one last example of how they have lied about what you did or said, and you have a chance to respond to that.
Well, I guess the other one, Gary, just to say, is that I was involved as an expert in the MMR vaccine litigation in the UK, and I did so because I sincerely believe that these children had not been given access to the process of justice, that when their parents died or became infirm, there was nothing for them. They were going to die on the streets because the system did not care and had made no provision. And so they at least needed access to the process of justice to determine whether, at a legal level, the vaccine caused their problem. Now, I made it absolutely clear in the national newspapers that I was acting as an expert in this case. I told my colleagues in a letter that went to all of my colleagues and my senior colleagues, letting them know of my position and my need to do this. So I was accused of never having told my colleagues this, keeping them in the dark and not telling the editor of The Lancet. In fact, the editor of The Lancet knew, and this came out of the General Medical Council, surprisingly to him, that he knew with clear documentary evidence at least a year before the publication of The Lancet paper that I was acting as an expert. He'd been informed directly by the lawyers themselves, despite the fact that it had already been in the national press. And I was accused of not telling anyone that it was a secret. It was not a secret, and Brian Deer has perpetuated that misinformation time and time again. And when it came to disclosing in The Lancet, in the first paper, the children were absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the litigation at the time of their referral to the Royal Free. They came for clinical reasons. They were not sourced by lawyers, as he has alleged. They were not recruited for the purpose of experimentation, for propagating vaccine litigation. They came because they were sick and needed help. And I followed the rules, the disclosure rules of The Lancet, to the letter at that time. And I was accused when I came to the General Medical Council. I was tried under the existing rules, which are very, very different now, 10 years on, than they were before. And I was found guilty under the existing rules. What system of law is it that you conduct yourself in one way under a certain set of rules, and then 10 years later you're tried under a new set of rules that did not pertain to that time? Absolutely extraordinary. But there's just another example, Gary, of the problem. But nonetheless, despite all of that, this work goes on. It's going to continue. The parents, the children aren't going away. This problem isn't going away. I'm not going away. So whatever they do, Gary, it's not going to stop. This work will continue.
Dr. Andrew Wakefield, we are going to do a major investigation on this reporter and on the type of reporting that Anderson Cooper and others have done. This is the beginning of our disclosures, not the end. And the American public can look at the evidence, pro and con, and make up their own mind. But when you have outlined every single rebuttal with documentation and clear and unequivocal evidence to the charges against you, and show anyone weighing that would have to be just dumbstruck by why is it the British people haven't got it? And we understand why the British government, they're as corrupt as we are. I mean, after all, how rare is it for the British government and their official agencies to ever acknowledge their errors? And yet they are aplenty over there, no different than ours. But the public are not stupid. The public, given the facts, will make their own mind up. Thank you very much. We will keep on top of this case, Dr. Andrew Wakefield.
Gary, thank you very much.
I'm Gary Nall. And we are now going into our studio in New York City to continue this discussion before we go to our next guest. And our next guest has got some really strong insights into the RAND Corporation and its role in the creation of the American empire with Alex Abella, who is a Cuban-American author and investigative journalist. He is a graduate from Columbia University School of Journalism, and he writes on the history of forces of power. He is a contributor to Los Angeles Times, Huffington Post, and he has also written Shadow Enemies, Something That's Important, and Soldiers of Reason, the RAND Corporation to Rise the American Empire. We'll talk with him in just a moment. Just final thoughts from Richard in studio, because Richard is a scholar. Richard has spent thousands of hours, as have I, investigating the allegations on this issue of vaccinations, mandatory vaccines, their safety, and relationship to autism. Now, one of the statements that was made, Richard, Gail, is that nowhere else in the world could this information be found that he is alleging, Andrew Wakefield, on this association. But you have come across a great deal of information from other countries and other scientists that fully support Andrew Wakefield. Would you share that with
us,
please?
Yes, we'll be writing on this more. I'm just kind of pulling a lot of this together. But one of the main issues with Wakefield's research, and which raised alarms to people, was the fact that these children with these very serious digestive conditions and Crohn's disease and whatnot, the measles virus that was discovered, and you can say more or less embedded in the tissue, was that of the vaccine. It was not that of a wild virus. And that was really what Dr. Wakefield was finding. And we don't completely understand the relationship of what we call a gut-brain barrier, the relationship between our gut and the brain that can cause neurological problems. This is still an area of medical science that's still being further and further explored, even though we know that such a relationship exists. So this research that Wakefield first reported on in The Lancet has been reproduced independently without Dr. Wakefield's as an advisor or counselor on it. Probably the most important one was just within the past year was at Wake Forest University School of Medicine, where they looked at 275 children with regressive autism plus bowel disease. And 82 of those tested so far, the 70 of those were all positive for the measles virus due to the vaccine. And this same kind of this study was also, same research was done at Trinity College in Dublin at the Department of Pathology by Dr. John O'Leary. He replicated these findings as well. I'm still looking at some. There was one that was just recently done in Japan that I just came across that I haven't fully researched. But we'll be pulling these together in our rebuttal as part of a larger piece, because this attack on Wakefield right now is coming at the same time as we are finding Paul Offit's book, which is the poster child of the vaccine pro-vaccine movement, University of Pennsylvania, scholar in infectious disease, who's just written a publication called Dangerous Choices, which is a very brutal, actually vicious at times, attack on the entire the anti-vaccine movement. And this is just, these are both perfectly timed. In fact, the release of these is just days apart from the British Journal of Medicine attack on Wakefield. So this is a much bigger picture that's going on, I think, and that's what we want to explore.
Within the very near future, Richard and I will have a major original investigative reporting piece fully documented, as all 621 articles have been, up on progressiveradionetwork.com for the people to see the other side of the story. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Gary.
Back in a moment with my guest, Alex Abella, on the RAND Corporation. You're going to learn a lot about this corporation, and then think back to how many times someone from the RAND Corporation has appeared on television giving us their special insights, and you didn't know this part of the story. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I've given the introduction to our guest, so let's go over and say hello to Alex Abella. Nice to have you with us today, Alex.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. The name's Abella.
Abella.
It's spelled Abella, but it's pronounced Abella.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Alex, when we think of the RAND Corporation, to me at least, I think of Bechtel and Halliburton.
Right.
We immediately think of a veil of secrecy, of an entity whose work we know is influential, but just how influential remains cloudy and out of the public sphere. And of course, this is how RAND, in my opinion, prefers to operate. As you have been the expert in this and have done the investigation, please take us now on the story that we did not know about the RAND Corporation.
Well, the RAND Corporation, I mean, at one point it was described as, you know, the government behind the government. There were so many people going in and out of the RAND Corporation and into public service and vice versa that, you know, it was called a revolving door. To give you the latest example would be Donald Rumsfeld, who went from being on the board of the RAND Corporation to being, you know, the Secretary of Defense, and adopting many of the plans for an agile army military that had been developed at the RAND Corporation and using it during our invasion of Iraq. So dates back all the way to 1946 when the RAND Corporation actually came up with a preliminary design of an experimental world-circling spaceship that is like the first kind of you know, orbiting satellite from which missiles and rockets could be launched, or at the very least to be used as a weather satellite as well. So they've been involved in government and in a way have reshaped our modern world since 1946. And a matter of fact, at one point in my book, I mean, I say that we're all the bastard children of Rand, and we don't even know it, because they have changed society so much, especially by the development of something that they called rational choice theory, you know, which posits that we're all selfish individuals, and there's no such thing really as patriotism or altruism or religion. These are all variants of egotism, and therefore, you know, there's nothing but the cult of the individual, or as they call the consumer sovereignty. So they have changed the world since 1946.
Well, take us through some of the things that they have been involved in that you would have concern that in a free and democratic society that
well,
we really shouldn't
that,
allow.
Certainly, certainly. Well, the main thing that concerns me above all is what I was just referring to rational choice theory, because it has turned us from being citizens with rights and responsibilities into consumers with choices. So it's changed the whole perspective of our existence nowadays. And I say that because it's rational choice theory, by positing a world in which there is only one concern, which is the concern of the individual, and by declaring in so many words that there's no such thing as a collective bargaining agreement that's valid, because you always have one group imposing its will on others. And by using it as the foundation for the deregulation of industry and of society, especially in the financial markets, it has changed the world enormously. And it has moved us away from being a cohesive nation to being a nation of disparate characters, of people who are only out for things for themselves instead of thinking of the greater good. This came out of the fight, the struggle of the Western civilized civilization with the Soviet Union, with the communist doctrine. But I think it has evolved to the point that it's untenable, and it should not be allowed.
That said, then, as we watch jobs in America being outsourced around the world, particularly
right.
in developing countries, and the
right.
tradition of the American industry and manufacturing being wiped out, one American industry is booming, stronger than ever, the military-industrial complex. And it seems that weapons, delivery systems, military technology are one of the last remaining resources we can capitalize through sales around the world. What role has the RAND Corporation played in the creation of the military-industrial spy complex as we know it today?
Well, I'll have you know that the military-industrial complex, that phrase actually came out in President Eisenhower's speech, his farewell address in 1960. In 1960, when referring specifically to the RAND Corporation and people around it, you might say that the military-industrial complex is actually born out of the RAND Corporation and has been propelled by the people who are behind the RAND Corporation, who are still to a very large degree in it. Up until the 1970s, RAND received almost 80% of its budget from the federal government. And in the 1950s, Eisenhower, who obviously having been the commanding general of the Allied forces during World War II, had decided that there was no way that the United States or the West could survive a thermonuclear war with the Soviet Union. And therefore he began to extend an olive branch to the Soviets to see whether both spheres of influence, the Soviet and the American, could live in what was called peaceful coexistence. But that was opposed by a lot of industrialists who had a stake in the Pentagon, who had a stake in development of new weapons. And you have to realize that RAND itself was created in 1946 with the express purpose of developing new weapons of mass destruction, specifically the development of missiles. And that RAND was directly involved in the creation of the hydrogen bomb, and that many of its people had also worked in the Manhattan Project, and therefore that it had done all this work for the Air Force Force because it had been an adjunct of the Air Force. So therefore, when Eisenhower and his advisors tried to extend to achieve peaceful coexistence with the Soviet sphere, there was a cry raised among all these industrialists who felt that, you know, that should not be done. There was a man out of Iran named Herman Kahn in the late 1950s who came up with a book called On Thermonuclear War, who postulated that we would be able to survive a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, that we'd be able to go into tunnels, dig fallout shelters, into subway systems, into mines and stuff like that. And it really didn't matter whether, 10 million people die, because at the end, as long as you had some Americans surviving at the end, that we would have won that war. What he did was popularize a lot of ideas that had been circulating around Iran at that time. Some people compare that, to Nazi theory, and popularizing mass slaughter. But it didn't matter, because what these guys were trying to do is that they had this whole ideology that was based on numbers. And to a very large degree, they still do that today. So getting back to the military-industrial complex, when Eisenhower starts attempting to achieve some kind of coexistence with the Soviet Union, all of a sudden there's all these reports of a so-called missile gap with the Soviet Union, that the United States was falling behind on the arms race with the Soviet Union. And a lot of that information came out of the RAND Corporation, scientists who were affiliated with RAND, and that wanted to actually increase the defense budget, while the President Eisenhower, wanted to decrease the defense budget. So as a result of that, then they put all their money on a dark horse named John F. Kennedy, who obviously won. And among the reasons why he won, because of his argument saying that there was a missile crisis, and that the Soviet Union was going to win, and that the United States had gotten soft, and that we had to increase our defense budget, and which is like music to the ears of all these industrialists, and thus became the phrase, the military-industrial complex that was so famously coined by President Eisenhower. So ever since then, the Iran and the military-industrial complex have been working hand in hand, and to this very day.
Just one of the dark sides of Camelot and the so-called best and brightest, of which Kennedy was one.
Matter of fact, yes, because what Kennedy did is that he recruited all the most brilliant people that he could find within RAND to go in and reshape the Pentagon. And, they were called, again, not just the best and the brightest. They were intent. Here's one thing that most people are not aware of. Before Kennedy, the Secretary of Defense was actually seen as just an overseer between all the different competitions, the competition between all the different branches of the military, between the Navy, the Air Force, and they would all be vying for a particular slice of the budget out of Congress. But there would be no central authority that would actually be in control of all these different operations, to make sure that there would be no replication of weaponry, that there would be no direct competition that would drain resources. So when Kennedy comes in and he names McNamara, Robert McNamara, who had been the youngest president and reorganized the Ford Corporation, and he names him to head the Pentagon. And then McNamara then borrows something that RAND had developed called systems analysis, which is a way of analyzing structures and systems. And he puts him in charge of the Pentagon, and then McNamara starts recruiting all these people from RAND. They come from RAND, and they totally rework the Pentagon. And after that, the principle of systems analysis is then expanded by President Johnson to the rest of the federal government. So in a way, you could say that RAND reshaped the federal government, starting with Kennedy.
And today, $1.43 trillion on and offline,
yes,
from all associated sources, is how much we spend on the military-industrial complex, or more than the entire world, every country put together, and then double that And you then see today the Secretary of Defense saying, well, we're going to have to increase our military around China because China's increasing theirs. The game never stops, as if every American is a complete blathering idiot who can't see through this. And some Americans are disconnected from reality, but show them the truth and they'll pay attention. Today, my final important question for you is that there's a resurgence of interest in the writings of Ayn Rand, her books being the best-selling works after the Bible in the United States. And we've seen her work resurrected in the Tea Party, Clarence Thomas, Alan Greenspan, Ron Paul, many other members of the GOP, as many well-known names have passed through Rand, who we would associate with the rise of American imperialism, Paul Wolfowitz, Henry Kissinger, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Pearl, and others. Is there any relationship between Ayn Rand, R-A-N-D, and...
I know, it's totally coincidental, even though, I mean, it's really curious, isn't it, that it would be the two main advocates of this doctrine of total selfishness, of devolution of government, of narrow-mindedness, that the belief that there is nothing in the world but one's own self, that both of these main advocates of such a restrictive ideology should bear the same name, even though there's no direct connection. Rand came as an acronym. It was research and development, and it was only supposed to be a temporary name until they came up with another name. Well, they never did, so it stuck.
I understand. No, she was born in Russia, and I understand her background very well, and the author of Atlas Shrugged and many others. Here's what's ironic to me, that the people who have been pro-war and always increasing the power of the military-industrial complex, and now exceeding even the military-industrial complex in some quarters, is the private spying agencies and the intelligence agencies. They all consider themselves, in effect, Christian crusaders. But they were all advocates of Ayn Rand, who was an atheist.
Exactly.
And,
yes.
And to me, I don't know how anyone could not see the contradiction. If you're going to be Donald Rumsfeld or Paul Wolfowitz and keep saying, and Richard Pearl, and talking about God and country, well, where does exactly the philosophy that you hold so dear to your heart with Ayn Rand, who is a blathering idiot, in my opinion, an anti-intellectual, if you ever... I would love a chance to debate her, because you could drive a truck through every one of her assertions, from her hard work, characterization with Gary Cooper in the movie, and Patricia Neal. None of that do we see in the real world as she would like us to believe. We are not inherently selfish. We are not all out for our own good. We are not all of one mind that it's the survival of the fittest, don't help the next person. If you're in a boat, keep them out of the boat, let them drown.
That's exactly my point. That's exactly what I wanted to point out.
Let me just finish my thought. So how in the dickens do you end up saying that you are for a Christian moral majority, a new spiritual Christian consciousness or Jewish consciousness, and then turn around and be an advocate of a woman who was one of the most demonic thinkers, she was anti-intellectual, anti-spiritual, anti-humanistic, and anti-ethical. How in the world can you master believing in both simultaneously? You have the final word here.
I have no idea how you can do that, although I do know that people, you know, when your self-interest is at stake, when you have a lot of money before you, you will go through whatever ideological contortions it is that you have to go through in order to get your hands on that money. That's just the way it is, because a lot of these people have been paid by the military-industrial complex to come up with this kind of ideology, and therefore they will come up with a reason. It's that simple. As I mentioned in the book, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book and what I found out about it and what I found out while I was doing all the research on Rand, which is, you know, this ideology, which as it was developed into a real structure, not a called rational choice theory, that has affected so many aspects of modern life. You know, it's like I tell my children, life used to be so different, even, you know, 40 years ago, before before Reagan, and even before Carter, we lived in a different society back then. We were not so all consumed with a pursuit of profit, with the thinking that there's only one individual that counts, and that's me. We lived in a different world, and I think that it's this pernicious doctrine that was developed by the Rand Corporation and perpetuated by the followers and acolytes of Ayn Rand that has changed the world. And that's why I say we're all living, you know, we're all Rand's bastard children.
Alex, thank you very much for being on today.
It's been my pleasure.
The book is called Soldiers of Reason, and the website is abellaweb.com. All the best to you, Alex. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more. If you miss anything, go to the archives. Have a nice day.